minutes. You're not getting close. You don't do that. Deputy Director of Processing of the Interstate Commerce Commission. And we'll have Arthur Bacon, the Regional Director of Region 6 Interstate Commerce Commission. And I'd appreciate it, gentlemen, if you come up to the table here, and we're looking for some help. Any comments you might have is most appreciated for the committee here. I think you're pretty well aware of what we're into and what we're working on. Oh, by the way, Mike, would you care to join us up front here, Mike Davis? Join us up front here, if you will. Senator Halford is with us, too, for the record. And we have a quorum, incidentally, of the committee, Senator Biggs, myself, and Senator Farrington. It's all yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I'm Louis Gittimer, Deputy Director of the Interstate Commerce Commission's Rail Section. With me is Art Bacon, the Commission's Regional Managing Director of Region 6, which includes the state of Alaska. I have some brief comments to make, and then I will be glad to try and answer any of your questions. At this time, the Interstate Commerce Commission holds no statutory authority to regulate the Alaska Railroad. Exclusive authority over the operations of the railroad was granted to the President under the Alaska Railroad Act of 1914. And delegated to the Secretary of the Interior in 1915, and then to the Secretary of Transportation in 1966. In 1963, President Kennedy delegated certain rate review authority to the Interstate Commerce Commission. That executive order was recently superseded by one issued by President Reagan in August of 1983. The new executive order clarifies the rate-making authority of the Commission over the Alaska Railroad. It also expressly incorporates certain revisions made to the rate provisions of the Interstate Commerce Act by the Staggers Rail Act of 1980. Thus, Executive Order Number 12434 subjects the Alaska Railroad to the major rate provisions of the Interstate Commerce Act, including those made by the Staggers Act. The Staggers Act, which was a major deregulatory step, assures railroads substantially more rate freedom than was afforded under prior law. Continues the policy started under the Railroad Revitalization and Regulatory Reform Act of 1976 by substantially eliminating rate regulation of railroads where there is effective competition. Some of the major points of the Staggers Act include establishing a specific 14-point rail transportation policy to guide the Commission in its regulation of the railroad industry, providing the Commission with jurisdiction to determine rate reasonableness only when a rail carrier is serving a captive shipper, providing that a rate may not be set below a reasonable minimum, that is predatory pricing. And predatory pricing has been defined as setting a rate below the directly variable costs of providing rail transportation. The Commission also prescribes a percentage rate increase for rate index for rail carriers compensate the railroads for inflationary cost increases. This is done annually. The Staggers Act requires the Commission to use its powers to suspend a proposed rate only upon a protest. And the Commission must complete a proceeding when it suspends and investigates the proposed rate within 5 months, or else the rate takes effect automatically. There are essentially two ways to oppose a rate change. One is through the suspension process I just described, where the railroad files a rate, and before it becomes effective, someone protests the rate. The person who would protest the rate would have to be a shipper using the railroad service. The Commission then decides whether to investigate the rate and suspend the implementation of the rate, or the Commission can just investigate the rate and allow the rate to go into effect. If at the end of an investigation, the Commission finds that the rate is unreasonable, it can require the railroad to pay reparations to the shipper. Another method of protesting a rate is for the rate to go into effect and the shipper then file a complaint alleging that the rate is unreasonably high. The Commission then holds a hearing. An initial decision is issued by an administrative law judge. That decision can be appealed to the commission's employee board, and their decision can then be appealed to the commission. The commission's decision is, of course, appealable to the United States Court of Appeals. A number of other provisions of the Staggers Act include one which authorizes one or more railroads to enter into contract rates with one or more shippers. It also provides standards and procedures for applying surcharges to existing joint rates and for canceling the application of a joint rate to a particular route. The Staggers Act requires carriers to reduce and maintain a specific rate level on non-ferrous recyclables. Shippers and railroads are provided greater service options because the railroads can establish a lesser degree of liability for the shipments. There are certain services which are exempted from rate discrimination provisions of the current Interstate Commerce Act. The Staggers Act also encourages competitive pricing by modifying the activity that a rate bureau may permit its members to engage in if it is to be approved by the Commission and immune from the antitrust laws. The Commission has recently ruled that only direct connectors are allowed to discuss rates with an exemption from the antitrust laws. Commission's activities under the Staggers Act also permit tariffs to be filed and become effective within shorter notice periods. And perhaps one of the major aspects of the Staggers Act was to permit the Commission to exempt rail carriers from its regulation for specific transportation, service, or transaction. The Staggers Act also encouraged the creation of short-line railroads by either private enterprise or states where the larger railroads have or are seeking to withdraw from that transportation market.
After may I ask a question at this point? I hope that if we don't screw up your testimony,
Feel free to interrupt at any time.
What is your definition of a short line railroad in respect perhaps to the Alaska Railroad? Would that be a type of railroad you're talking about as a short line railroad?
It conceivably could be a short line railroad. The short line railroad is just a generic term, generally used to describe railroads which are not Class 1 carriers, the large railroads with over $100 million in gross revenues annually.
Yeah, that's us.
That's us.
About $100 million.
That does not count.
Okay, thank you very much. I just wanted to ask the interject there. It's
a generic term. There is an American Short Line Railroad Association, which consists of, I believe, mainly Class 3 carriers. And those are railroads that have revenues of below $10 million.
The last point you made was exempting specific commodities and markets from rate regulation.
From rate regulation or any type of regulation.
How is that done?
The commission can act under this statute in one of two ways. Either the commission can act on its own motion, or it can act on a request by a party. The exemption can take the effect of either exempting an entity totally from regulation, or it can exempt a very minor aspect. In the more minor cases, the commission will receive a petition from someone, issue a decision, I would say in most cases, approving the exemption and giving anyone who would be interested in opposing that exemption 30 days to seek reconsideration before the commission. In major exemption cases, and some of these would be where the commission has exempted all coal meant for export from regulation, exempted boxcars from regulation, the commission first issues a notice and requests comments on the proposal, and then, if necessary, holds further hearings on the issue.
Okay. Coal for export, is that a blanket exemption that exists now?
Yes.
From regulation?
From all Interstate Commerce Commission regulation and any state regulation which would apply.
What other blanket exemptions are in existence now that might apply to the commodities in Alaska Railroad? For example, pipe, North Slope, cargoes, or gravel hauls?
Those commodities have not been exempted. The exemptions have generally gone to fresh fruits and vegetables, a number of agricultural commodities, so very specific chemicals where there were very minor movements throughout the country, hops, barley, all trailer on flat car service.
So grains are exempt?
No, grain is not exempt.
Barley?
Hops. Hops for use in beer manufacture.
Hell no. How about intrastate shipping only and that stuff?
The intrastate shipment would also be exempted.
All of it? Excuse me.
The commission has, let me go back a little. In order for a state to regulate the intrastate movements, or its intrastate movements of its railroad, it has to be certified by the commission that it is regulating in accordance with federal standards and procedures. The commission has interpreted that to mean that a state must adopt all exemptions adopted by the commission. So that trailer on flat car operations would be exempt in interstate and intrastate movements.
Let me ask you a specific deal. I got a trailer unit out on a rail car outside. It goes on the rail, bringing it up, and it's a series of containers on the rail car already. Can I ship that from, say, Seattle on the barge to the railroad to Fairbanks and be under a deregulation?
The portion of the movement which the railroad controls would be exempt. So if the railroad were providing the barge movement to Anchorage, the rail movement to Fairbanks, and then the truck movement from Fairbanks, that entire movement would be exempt. If a separate company provides the front end of it and a separate company provides the motor end of it, then those portions would not be exempt.
The rail portion would be, not the water carrier truck.
So long unless the railroad itself is providing that service.
Do they have to own them, or can they be in a long-term contract with it? For instance, you got
to... The answer to both of your questions is no. It is not the ownership of a barge or a motor carrier or a long-term contract. It would be the railroad itself operating as a barge company and operating as a motor.
So if the railroad purchased or wanted to purchase, do they have to be total owners, or can they be part owners?
It doesn't. The question is not ownership. It is the railroad having...
Control?
Not control. The railroad performing the operations. It would be within the railroad company itself, not a separate entity performing the operations.
This is an exemption.
And it's an exemption from the ICC regs on rate setting.
As far as these are exemptions from all Interstate Commerce Commission regulation.
Could we get a list of those exemptions, the various commodity exemptions and the box? Could we have a list of those exemptions? Are they somewhere where we can get a hold of them?
Yes, they are. I can provide that.
Appreciate that very much if you could. And,
it's exempt from everything.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman. You're so far ahead of us on this topic, I don't know whether this question should be asked now, but just so you can think about it and then go on. I guess the question I would ask either now or at the end of your prepared statement is, then what impact of the Cypress Act does apply to the Alaska Railroad as you see us building it as a state entity?
Okay.
Now or later, whichever way, I just wanted to...
A great deal of the Staggers Act would apply. There are specific commodities which are exempted. I understand that the railroad does not handle that many boxcars, so that's a minor portion. But movements of gravel on the railroad are subject to jurisdiction of the commission.
Question at that point: gravel, you say? If it does not come across state line, is it still?
If it does not, at the present time, yes, it would be, because the state of Alaska has not chosen to regulate the railroad. Under the Staggers Act, the relationship between state regulation and federal regulation of railroads was drastically altered. Previously, states could regulate railroads, in essence, as they saw fit. Congress felt that this was quite harmful to the railroads, because the interstate rates were higher than the intrastate rates and subsidizing the intrastate rates. The Congress requires states to be certified by the commission to regulate intrastate commerce. And in order to be certified by the commission, the states must adopt the federal standards and procedures which are in effect.
What type of entity on a state level does that require? Does that require a quasi-judicial commission that actually does the regulating?
In most of the states, it is the State Public Service Commission, the State Public Utilities Commission.
Could be done by a public utilities commission.
Yes.
APUC.
Let me ask a question here. I don't know whether we touched on it or not. If a railroad's not subject to the antitrust laws, is it entitled to being deregulated? There have been a comment or two made that if it's if we don't have an antitrust law in there, then it wouldn't be entitled to deregulation. Is that your...
The commission's interpretation of deregulation is that in order, if you are being regulated and supervised by a governmental entity, then there is no harm in having antitrust immunity. But if you are deregulated and you are going out into the free market as any other enterprise, then along with that should come exposure to the antitrust laws.
As long as you're... run it by me again.
Prior to the Staggers Act of 1980, there was a very pervasive federal scheme of regulation. And since the federal government was overseeing, in essence, everything that was being done, then the commission could determine whether there were any collusive activities going on, whether the price fixing was resulting in unreasonable pricing for consumers. Now, with the reduced regulation, and that activity was all governed by antitrust immunity from the antitrust laws of the United States, the Sherman Act, the Clayton Act, the Federal Trade Commission Act. Now, where railroads have so much more freedom to act independently, price independently, their immunity from the antitrust laws to sit down and fix prices with the competitors has been repealed. What I mentioned earlier, the direct connector standard, means that if a railroad were to operate from Philadelphia to Chicago, and its movement were going onward from Chicago to the West Coast, it could not sit down with four other railroads that handle traffic from Chicago to the West Coast and have all of them in the room deciding what the price would be. It could sit down with each of the individual railroads and set a price over each of those four individual routes. And they may not be the same at the end.
Okay, in this case here, though, we've got one railroad in one state.
Right.
So they can pretty well set whatever tariff they want, can't they?
Up to a reasonable maximum, yes.
What is a reasonable maximum?
I can't tell you. I don't know. I can tell you that the commission's jurisdiction over rates does not begin until, well, it does not begin if you do not have a captive shipper. And to define a captive shipper, there's a specific way to define a captive shipper. A captive shipper only exists if the railroad's rate is first above a ratio of the revenues received by the railroad for the movement to the variable cost of providing the service of 175%. So if it costs the railroad $1 to provide the service, until their rate charge is over $1.75, no regulation would attach. They can move their rate up and down within that cap as much as they want. Then we go on to other tests, which see if the railroad is competitive, if it has any competition to also hold the price down. And we look.
Now, this is with another railroad.
Well, it is one with another railroad, and secondly, with other modes of transportation. If perhaps a motor carrier can provide the same service, the commission has recently found.
For the same price?
No, the same. It's not necessarily for the same price, but it's a comparable service to keep a cap on the railroad's price. Commission's recently found that aluminum ingots moving out of Oregon and Washington to the Gulf are not being, the shippers are not captive shippers because there is motor transportation available in competition to the railroads. Beyond the specific competition by other modes, we look at two other tests. They're called product and geographic competition. We look to see if there is a product which the user can substitute available, and that again serves as a cap on the price the railroad would charge. and then we look to see if the user can obtain the same commodity from a different area.
Senator Fix had a question.
You keep talking about to keep the cap on freight rates, special sections of the law or special things that kick in to make sure that the railroad won't overcharge.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we have friends in private industry who are afraid the railroad will undercharge because of government subsidies or whatever, and they will put them, the railroad then will have unfair low rates and will put them out of business. What are your comments on that, and what kinds of regulations are in either staggers or in ICC that would prevent that kind of thing?
There's a provision that railroads cannot charge predatory prices. The commission has defined predatory pricing as pricing below the directly variable cost of the movement, which means the cost of going from point A to point B. It doesn't include any of the overhead involved in running a railroad, any of the costs of the office staff, any of the costs of upgrading and maintaining the lines, the cost of the crew, the cost of the gas, that portion of the cost which is attributable to the engine and the cars on the move.
Can't charge less than that.
Senator, I think you have a question.
We consider that predatory pricing, and pricing below that is considered unlawful.
Excuse me, if I could follow through.
Okay.
So then there's a standard. Can I have that list then on the things that involve the predatory pricing? The charges. What is acceptable in
there,
that?
There's a commission.
You said the crew, the gas, the engine, the price of the cars.
Well, it's not the entire price of the cars. It's the price of the cars that is attributable to that.
To that run. Sure.
Okay. There's a specific commission rulemaking which goes into great detail in describing this. I can provide that for you.
I would appreciate that.
Senator Halford?
Yeah, just as a further follow-up on this, okay, predatory pricing is setting a rate below the direct variable compensation. That direct compensation,
the directly variable cost to the railroad.
Right. That directly variable cost does not include any allocation of fixed cost, does not include any cost to capital.
It includes,
unless it's optional capital, it has to be added, I would assume.
I believe it would include the cost of capital as a portion of the cost of the equipment.
Sure.
Okay, but in the case of a railroad that is run by the state, for example, there isn't a cost of capital component in their balance sheet, basically. If they in fact operate from year one with a grant of X million dollars, then there isn't any justification to pass that grant on in the tariff to recover it, because there's no responsibility to repay it. And does that mean that that in fact lowers their bottom floor substantially in terms of predatory pricing?
If the railroad is being subsidized, then conceivably the floor could be lowered.
Could be lowered? Okay.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, another follow-up. When you talked about rate appeal, you said the appeal is made by a shipper.
Yes.
Is there a provision for appeal by a competitive carrier on the basis of the rate being too low?
There would be a complaint filed that the carrier is pricing in a predatory manner. One carrier could file a complaint against another carrier.
Representative Davis?
Thank you. But they would take the criteria of what you said to determine if it was a predatory pricing based on these variable costs.
Yes, that's what the commission would use to decide that.
So it could easily be if this railroad, one of the things that's being stipulated is or proposed is that we give the railroad $60 million and then cut them loose. And given that, then they could easily set rates that would be predatory, at least in terms of other shippers, but maybe not in terms of your definition.
I don't know that a contribution to the railroad would necessarily mean it could easily set prices at a predatory level, because I think if they look out any time into the future, they'll see that continually setting prices at that level would require them to come back to the legislature for additional funding. And our experience with Conrail has been that, at least as of now, they will not come back to Congress for additional funding. and Congress is more than happy that Conrail will not come back to them for additional funding.
But there's no prohibition in Staggers or ICC from them doing that.
From?
As far as the...
From who doing what?
All they have to put in the floor of their rate is the direct variable cost.
For that movement, yes.
And yet, if that's all of their rates are based on, they will have no movements from which to cover the fixed costs, the general costs, and in fact would have to come back to some entity to pick up those portions of the overall operation of the railroad.
Or else go out of business.
And if we expected some protection from you in that area, we wouldn't get it.
As far as pricing between the direct and variable costs and the captive shipper ceiling, no, that's a free area for the railroads to raise and lower their prices.
So we have to handle that ourselves. We can't count on Staggers to cover them.
Mr. Fakes, Farron Camp, I think you have a comment, question.
Well, I think it's been answered. I was just looking at these variable costs and trying to figure out, for instance, if we were as a state having training classes.
We have more than we
Another way like that sometimes. That would be counted.
No, I do not think so.
Sorry to interrupt you. Continue on
that's
now.
Quite all right. After the date of the transfer of the Alaska Railroad, Section 608 of the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act of 1982 provides that the railroad shall be a rail carrier engaged in interstate and foreign commerce subject to the jurisdiction of the Interstate Commerce Commission under 49 U.S.C. Chapter 105 and all other acts applicable to rail carriers subject to that chapter, including the antitrust laws of the United States. Thus, following the transfer, in my opinion, the Alaska Railroad will be subject to the whole gamut of commission regulation. As far as rate matters are concerned, change from regulation under delegated authority to statutory authority will have limited impact except in the area of contracts. In addition to these matters, the Alaska Railroad will also become subject to a number of additional provisions of the Interstate Commerce Act. These include Chapter 109, involving licensing procedures which govern the acquisition, construction, operation, abandonment, and discontinuance of operations over rail lines, the financial assistance procedures, and the feeder line development program. Chapter 111 provides for the common carrier obligation, car service requirements, rail cost accounting principles, and reporting and record keeping requirements.
And back up a minute.
Rail cost accounting procedures?
Yes.
It's a certain way they keep their books?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Can you back up now and give me that in plain language now? Does that mean that we're going to be under regulation, period, as a state-operated railroad or a state-umbrella railroad? Or are there going to be more restrictions on it once it goes into private enterprise? Is there a change when it goes from the umbrella under the state when we move it over into the private sector? Now, which one applies? Does the thing apply to the state umbrella as well as it will to private enterprise?
From where the railroad is now, today, to where it will be when the state owns it, and then if the state eventually transfers it to private enterprise, regulation will be, there will be very little difference in the amount of regulation.
But if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gilman.
What you say, what I think I heard you say is that when the federal government transfers the railroad to the state, the amount of regulation that the state will, the railroad under state auspices will increase dramatically from what it is today.
The amount of regulation which could apply to the railroad if it takes certain actions would increase. Currently, if the railroad wants to build another 50-mile line, I don't think it does not have to come to the Interstate Commerce Commission. Sure. It probably has to get a great deal of approval from the Department of Transportation and funding.
But what my point is that there are several things that at this point in time under federal ownership that don't apply.
That is correct.
But under state ownership, they would apply.
Yes.
And under private ownership, the same things would apply.
Yes.
So the state-operated railroad, owned and operated railroad, will be essentially regulated by ICC as if it were privately owned.
Yes, it will be regulated as any other railroad in the country.
Okay, one question. Extension. I run my flag up when you did that. I want to run an extension from Fairbanks to the border. We got to come get you guys or ICC's permission
yep.
to do it.
Yes.
Yep.
All right, now what does that entail?
God, this guy's trip was worth it.
The, not necessarily. It entails the filing of an application with the commission seeking approval of the construction. One of the main areas that we look at when we're passing on construction applications is the environmental impacts.
Okay.
We also look at the need for the line, whether the competitive impacts of the line, whether there will be anything to ship over the line. But the commission has plenary jurisdiction over construction of railroad lines where it regulates railroads in the United States.
Okay, I got some mineral deposits out west that I want to put a railroad into. What effect? We got to get an environmental okay on it first, right?
Well,
through the ICC?
Well, the ICC would be preparing the environmental impact statement. And along with that, you would need the okay to go ahead with construction.
Any comments? Committee?
It's on what it's federal land.
Representative Davis?
Any
questions? Thank you.
Representative Davis?
Good question. If Alaska applied for and got an exemption from the regulations of ICC, if they, and that was acquired, and they still wanted to put in a new line out to the border, would they still have to go to the ICC to put in that
if,
new line?
If the state were to request an exemption from all ICC jurisdiction and it were to be granted, then the state would not have to come to the commission for approval to construct a new line.
Senator Fake?
It's my understanding that the ICC has to approve any bonding that the railroad would do also.
Yes, that's correct. Commission, any securities issuance by a railroad has to be approved by the commission.
How long does that take?
Not very long, usually. There is a statutory requirement that the application be filed with the commission and sent to the governor of each state in which the railroad operates. The governor then has 15 days to comment to the commission, and within about a week or two of that 15-day period, we issue a decision.
Okay, so that's oversight, the chief executive of the state of which the railroad is operating.
Well, it's not oversight by the chief executive. It's just notice to the chief executive.
Oh, just notice. He doesn't have veto or anything like that.
He can say whatever he wants to about the bond, and the commission can agree with him or disagree. We've had a recent case in the Midwest where a railroad wanted to issue probably close to $100 million in bonds, and the governors of three of the states came in filing comments very concerned about it, and the commission considered those comments and went ahead and authorized the issuance of the bonds.
Someone had a question down the end, I think, didn't it? I thought I saw it.
Senator Fahrenkamp. Just a minute. On this exemption from ICC regulations, that would come about maybe if ICC granted it. Mm-hmm. If the state had a public utilities commission that was handling the same regulatory function
no.
in the way it was being done?
No. If the state were to request exemption from the commission and the commission were to grant it, not only would the railroad be exempt from all federal ICC jurisdiction, but it would also be exempt from any jurisdiction of intrastate traffic as well, by, say, a public utilities commission.
Are there any railroads thank you, Mr. Chairman, that are exempt?
There are some small railroads, yes.
Oh, we're small railroads.
Well, define small railroad for me.
A new railroad which was created to operate 5 or 10 miles of track.
Realistically, Mr. Chairman, may I
continue?
Realistically, is there any way at this point in time the ICC would exempt the 452 miles or whatever the Alaska Railroad from regulations?
I would think you would have at least an even shot. The Interstate Commerce Commission is very pro-deregulation. We had in the Northeast a number of rail commuter authorities were set up in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania to handle the commuter operations in those areas. And they came within the Commission's regulation. Their operations would have been regulated by the Commission, so we would have been involved in all of their fare squabbles after they had finished with them. People would have then had the opportunity to come to the Commission and have the Commission rule on them. And each of the authorities requested that the Commission exempt it from all regulation, and the Commission agreed to grant the exemption.
In other words, if we wanted to ask for exemption, we do whatever. How do you go about doing it?
Okay. And you would file a petition with the Commission asking for exemption, explaining why.
Right, would that be the railroad now or the legislature in this case here?
In your case, it's kind of tough to distinguish between the two.
That's my point.
If we set up a corporation, though, would it be the board of directors of the corporation?
The corporation could file, yes.
But the legislature could file also.
I would think the legislature could conceivably file. There's no requirement as to who files the exemption request.
Senator Howell, question?
Yeah, I'm a little bit confused on exemption or not exemption. Initially, on the rate question, you said to get exemption, we would need to create a state entity that basically follows the pattern of regulation.
No, I did not say to get for an exemption. I said to be able to regulate intrastate movements.
Okay.
Regulation and exemption are at the opposite ends of the spectrum. For deregulation, the Commission...
We have three alternatives. Your regulation, state regulation, or no regulation.
Well, there is... I don't think there is anywhere where it would be solely state regulation. There would be state... There could be state regulation of the intrastate movement solely. But anything that is moving in interstate or foreign commerce would be subject to the Interstate Commerce Commission. That would include anything that would be coming up from, say, Seattle.
But if we take the exemption route, then we can't have intrastate regulation. Or can we?
You can probably craft your exemption any way you want to cut out pieces of regulation. Although, to avoid interstate regulation and not avoid intrastate regulation may create something that I don't know that you'd want to be involved in. You would create a very peculiar type of animal.
That doesn't stop us.
Senator Moss, if taking this one step farther, if the state were to apply, the railroad were to apply for exemptions from any or all of the ICC regs, under the Staggers Act, then would all the antitrust laws then would apply?
Yes.
And they do apply right now. You're saying they apply right now, I believe was your testimony, under the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act.
Yes.
They do apply now.
The Interstate Commerce Commission can grant limited antitrust immunity. And it is... The grants of immunity are becoming more and more limited as time goes on and as the railroads become more and more...
You do not read the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act then as having a grant of immunity from the antitrust laws under that act?
No, I do not.
Any other comments?
That's different than what we've heard.
Yes.
We have a whole different flavor to this thing right now.
Strange, isn't it, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. It's got a little different flavor to it.
That's what we said.
Let me continue. There is Chapter 113 of the Interstate Commerce Act, which governs finance procedures, including the issuance of carrier securities, equipment trusts, and other security interests, has limitations on ownership, restrictions on officers and directors, limitations on pooling and division of earnings, the consolidation, merger, and acquisition of control of carriers, and changes in financial structure. Chapter 115 of the Interstate Commerce Act governs federal and state relations, including the Commission's authority over intrastate transportation. Chapter 117 governs the extent of enforcement remedies that were excluded by Executive Order 12434. And Chapter 119 governs civil and criminal penalties for violations of the Interstate Commerce Act.
I missed one.
Senator Farrenkamp?
113.
What did 113 do?
That's my favorite.
Bingo.
It governs the issuance of any carrier securities.
Oh, bonding.
Stocks, bonds. It limits ownership of railroads. It places restrictions on interlocking officers and directors between carriers. It limits the pooling and division of earnings between carriers. And it places specific requirements for ICC approval on the consolidation, merger, or acquisition of control of other carriers.
And the Alaska Railroad, right now, is a federal entity, doesn't go through those acts, right?
That's correct. Of course, I don't know if the Alaska Railroad issues any securities these days or just goes to FRA and asks for a handout.
One question. You mentioned limits ownership. The possibility, if we get this thing, we're going to get hung with it from here on out?
That's not what it means.
Yeah.
No, it means that if...
What does it say when it limits the ownership? What do you mean by that? In other words, who can buy it, who can own it, who can run it, or whatever?
It limits transfer of ownership. If another carrier wants to acquire the railroad or someone wants to acquire the railroad's assets, that would need approval by the ICC.
In other words, if B&O wanted to buy it, well, we'd have to get y'all approval.
Right. Or if the Alaska Railroad wanted to buy...
They just have to approve.
Sea land. That would require approval from the commission.
We have a bid yet, Gordon?
We're not sea land.
No bid?
No.
Senator Halpern.
Yeah. There are other railroads that are owned by either state or local government entities. What are examples of how they've dealt with ICC regulation and something that you may be able to just think about?
Some of them, essentially, what happens when states acquire a line of railroad is they acquire the line in conjunction with the shippers so that the service will continue to the shippers. The state buys the line, usually sets up an authority or a special commission to own the line, and it then contracts with someone to operate the line. The operator of the line's only obligations to the state are those under the contract. Otherwise, it runs the railroad as it sees fit. And it either elects to be subject to all ICC regulation or a portion of it, or it seeks to be exempt from ICC regulation.
You said that you end up with a combine of shippers and government entity. In the state, what the real direction is a combine of recipients and the state to continue the service. I don't know how that works.
What do you mean by recipients?
The reason for the state's interest in the railroad, I think, is coming more from a public need for goods than a shipper's need for route.
Public's need for goods at the price the railroad can provide them at, as opposed to a competitor of the railroad?
Well, that's what's perceived.
What is the difference between that and the
shippers? It was just a different way to explain it, and I was trying to figure out what the difference is there.
I don't know that there is a difference.
You're trying to figure out the social benefit versus the whatever?
Well,
Senator Gilman, I think you might have had a comment.
Well, I'm trying to sort this out, Mr. Chairman, in my own mind. And I'm not trying to say that you've been misled. I'm not saying that at all, but I think this is beginning to put the thing in perspective that at this point, if we purchase the railroad as a state, regardless of how we set it up for operation, line agency, corporation, whatever, we're going to be subject to all of the ICC regulations as if it were in private ownership.
Yes.
And we are subject to antitrust law.
Yes.
Now, it is our understanding, or my understanding, that we could exempt ourselves from antitrust law.
I am not sure that you would be able to do it for the railroad. This is an area where I'm speaking solely from opinion, because it is a very cloudy area in the law right now, the extent to which the state action exemption from the antitrust laws applies to any activity, particularly an activity of this type where the state, for all intents and purposes, is setting up a corporation and saying, we're setting it up, now go act like a business. That is not really what the focus of the state action exemption was. The state action exemption was intended for instances where a state told a business, you have to do this. You are a pharmacy. You have to set your prices at this specific level, where it is mandated by the state law that a certain specific action be taken. In those instances, the Justice Department and the courts have said that, yes, here is where the state action exemption clearly applies. Once you go beyond that, the Justice Department has taken a very, very narrow reading of the state action exemption from the antitrust laws. And
had I misstated?
No.
Isn't that what we were understanding?
Is that fair, Cam?
For instance, I think I'm getting what you're saying. If we, as we write or require, we say they must, for instance, divide passengers, which is always easy, then would that area be exempt from antitrust?
I don't see any, by telling them to provide passenger service, I don't see where that would create anything that would raise a question under the antitrust laws.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that's a service that we want to see the railroad continue, even though
right.
It doesn't make any money. In fact, it's a losing money proposition for the railroad.
I think what you need to focus on are the activities that the railroad would conduct that could be considered anti-competitive and subject to either a Justice Department prosecution or a private action. And those activities are what you're concerned about under the antitrust laws. You're not concerned about the day-to-day operations of how the train runs back and forth.
But what they charge for the movement.
Even what they charge isn't as important as how they got to what they're charging. If they sit down with their competitors, if there is a trucking company which runs parallel to the railroad line, and they say, okay, we're going to sit down and we're both going to charge the same price to move the commodities. That is what the antitrust laws are aimed at. That is clear price fixing.
Senator Fahrenkamp, I think, had a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mary.
Lou, if the railroad, now let me see if I can get this straight. If the railroad management right now, their pricing guy, sat down with Hydrotrain and Union Pacific, and they all sat down in one room and said, we're going to move lumber out of Chicago to Spinard Builders in Anchorage, how much is that going to cost? Is that,
that's
legal?
Falls within the direct connector standard, because
okay.
You've got Union Pacific coming out of Chicago,
right,
taking the goods up to the
Hydrotrain.
Yeah, Seattle, Prince Rupert, whatever.
And then Hydrotrain coming up to Anchorage, and then the Alaska Railroad going on from Anchorage.
Sure.
That's what the Commission means by the direct connector standard.
Okay, that's
now,
okay.
Now, you would have problems if you had not only Union Pacific in the room, but you also had Burlington Northern,
Oh, if the lumber was coming out of Georgia, say, and you had Southern Pacific in the room, and then it connected with Burlington, and then
well,
you...
Well, no, not connected, not connected, but if they parallel...
Got it.
Okay, that's where you run into problems, and that's where the commission has said there is no immunity whatsoever.
That's where they said, okay, fellas, we're going to make $200 a...
Senator Halford, you had a question or comment?
The place where the immunity applies, as I understand it, is if we as a legislature, for example, said that the railroad will charge no more than, or the railroad will charge 10% less than the bus transportation cost to drop the passengers off at McKinley Park. By statute, we'd have told them to follow the competitor's price, which if they got together and did that, would probably be price fixing. It might be predatory pricing as well. If we said it had to be the same price, it would be price fixing. But we directed it by law, and that was would probably be covered by the exemption.
I think that may.
But that's the only kind of thing. We have to direct the specific action.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gill.
I am totally confused on the antitrust provisions, and I'm trying to find the... section that covers that in the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act.
Here's the transfer.
But I thought the Alaska Transfer Act said that we could exempt ourselves from the antitrust regulation. Isn't that the way you understood
it? That was my understanding, but I'm hearing different testimony here today.
And that we could do it by our own action.
I see Mark stirring around back in and back. Mark, you got any rebuttal on this?
So I helped create the confusion. Senator, what you have in the federal transfer legislation under Section 608, which includes...
Hold it.
Wait. Page who?
Page 18. 45 U.S.C. 1207. 608A1, right underneath the title, State Operation.
Got it.
If you read through that, it specifies that, among other acts, the antitrust laws apply after transfer. It also, the last sentence of A1 reads, nothing in this title shall preclude the state from explicitly invoking by law any exemption from the antitrust laws as may otherwise be available.
Okay.
Now, the statement, it may not have been correct before properly stated, but there's nothing in the federal transfer legislation which precludes invoking the state action exemption. There remains an issue, and I think our attorneys down in Seattle would say the same thing, that this area of the law is murky, whether a blanket exemption could be obtained. There's language that could do that. I think they would tell you they would not sit here with certainty and say that language in and of itself, depending on how else you set up this corporation, will in fact evoke the state action exemption. There's a distinction. Nothing in the federal bill has been done to preclude obtaining that if it's available otherwise.
At this point, what you're saying, Mark, if do we have it in this bill, 352, where we are looking for an exemption from it? In other words, if it's not in the bill, then we're under antitrust.
That's correct, and you don't have language in the bill.
We're under antitrust.
Of course, the Sheffield administration is not expressed any policy about one way or the other is to do that. On a staff level, as a result of your request on Saturday, I made available to my language, which was drafted 2 years ago, that would go into the findings section and into another section of the statute that would make an attempt to invoke on a blanket basis a state action exemption.
Or exemption.
And it's structured on the current case law, current Supreme Court law, and sort of the state of the art of what you would have to do.
Well, let me ask a little question then, if I may, while we're doing this. In your opinion, under the law and the Transfer Act and your regulations and everything, can we exempt ourselves with our legislation, our entity legislation, and not get crossways with you folks?
As far as the Interstate Commerce Commission is concerned, we don't have any problem. Your problems would come with the Department of Justice and probably even more than the Department of Justice with private antitrust actions with the possible treble damage penalty.
Yeah, Toad's back there nodding their head. They can't wait to file.
Gordon is really having a ball with that one, I think.
I've been told an antitrust action is a two-edged sword where the plaintiff quite often turns into the defendant overnight and is extremely sorry that they filed the suit.
Hear that, Gordon?
Well, I guess what I'm asking for any of the group, the work group here, or somebody, do we have this in this legislation, or are we going to put it in this legislation, and will it work if we want to exempt ourselves from antitrust?
I think we've just been told that whatever we do, we're going to court.
Well, I'm just asking.
I don't think that's entirely right, Mr. Chairman. That if we accept the railroad and its provision, the antitrust applies and the ICC regulation apply, why would we go to court? The question is, do we want to accept it under those conditions?
Comment, Senator Howell?
The only case where we're in a bind is if the state takes an action which forces the railroad in following that action to act contrary to antitrust. And in that case, that's exactly where the exemption is meant to apply and probably does. That's the only case. If we tell them to do something as a state that's contrary to antitrust otherwise, just as your example in a pharmacy, if we did it to the rate for passengers to McKinley Park, that would probably be an area where the antitrust exemption would apply. If we don't do anything that tells them to violate antitrust, there's no problem.
Is that true?
I would agree with that statement.
Good.
That doesn't mean that the railroad may not take some actions independently.
We're running long here. Mark, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, I got the impression there's one other thing that might help, and Lou said this earlier, but in saying other things about the full rubric of ICC regulation may have somewhat confused us all. And if I understand it correctly, at least as a result of the executive order that went into place this summer, the railroad is a federal agency in relation to the ICC, is generally subject to the same level and type of regulation that it will be following transfer. Instead of an executive order, you're now going to have a statutory reference.
Yes, for the actions which the railroad has taken the last few years, the ICC regulation would be minimal, extremely minimal.
Operating under it right now.
Yes, compared to the regulation that is occurring today, if the state were to take the railroad tomorrow, the difference in regulation would be
minimal.
Now, I'd like a list from you of all the chapters under ICC, of the licensing provision, the financial assistance, common carrier, the real cost accounting, all that kind of stuff. You got all that?
Mark?
Why are you waving your hand around? Are you stopping me on something?
No.
Oh, okay. So my question is, I'd like that information if I could.
I think we...
Can we help you?
I think in my office I probably have an extra copy of the Interstate Commerce Act that sent that.
Oh, we need that.
That's got everything in it.
I have that sweet here.
Okay.
I have to know how many pages.
The other thing is that if the railroad right now is under the ICC regulations, and unless the state specifically goes after trying to be exempt from any or some or all or a portion of those regulations, one of the regulations, a real cost accounting procedure, number 115, is it?
Yes.
Okay. If we, as a state then, in the legislation that's creating this creature, demand a certain kind of accounting system or accounting procedure, with the rare and different from your real cost...
From our accounting.
Then they'd have to do two systems?
Conceivably, they could.
Thank you very much.
They could.
About